Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
On the cybersecurity front, every week seems to bring a new threat. A recent one in the category of advanced persistent threat is known as Volt Typhoon. Its apparent foreign nation state origin is aimed at critical infrastructure. I got more from former Energy Department cyber manager, now CEO of NetRise, Tom Pace. Tom, good to have you in studio.
Happy to be here, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And you and your company have been tracking something called Volt Typhoon. Colorful sounding name, has a slightly Far East sound. What is it and what should we worry about?
So Volt Typhoon is the name given to a advanced persistent threat group that is operating out of China that has been targeting U.S. critical infrastructure assets and other assets. They have been compromising devices on military bases, installations, critical infrastructure assets, security cameras, firewalls, devices and assets that typically are much more difficult to detect and find with ease than a traditional like laptop, desktop, something like that.
And you call them an advanced persistent threat. What does that mean exactly in this context? And what is it that they're putting on these devices that could have the potential to do something?
APT is kind of a generalized term these days. It's really just the characterization of an entity within, it could be a nation state government, it could be a criminal syndicate, it could be an underground hacking group. It basically just represents a well-financed, very intentional group of people that could either be funded by the government or not. Typically, they are in some way, either directly or indirectly through some kind of proxy. In this scenario, it appears that there is a desire to maintain access into critical infrastructure assets for purposes that are difficult to predict but seem like malicious ones, to say the least.
Well, let's take the example of surveillance cameras. They put software on there through the network that these cameras are on. They could turn them off. They could point them away from something you need to watch. Could they capture voice and video of people pursuant to making deep fakes, for example? That kind of thing?
All of that is certainly in the realm of possibility. What seems to be a more likely set of circumstances is it's a very good place to maintain persistence. It's very hard to find malicious activity and behavior on a security camera. You can't install antivirus on a security camera. You can't install software known as endpoint detection and response software. You can't bring to bear the same kind of technical solutions that you can on a normal workstation or computer or server.
Or a smartphone or a laptop PC.
Smartphones have the same problem. You can't really install software.
But what I mean is for the network operations centers that agencies operate or that might be, you know, in Guam, they can see the devices and monitor devices, including smartphones and mobile devices, as well as servers and network devices.
Correct.
What is not visible to the average SOC then are these types of IoT devices that might be in a factory or might be in a production facility or might be in a perimeter security system.
That's right. Typically, at best, you have visibility into what it is and where it is. That's typically where it ends for a lot of organizations, even very mature organizations, even Fortune 100. So even though the federal government has a significant amount of assets, you still have a very wide spectrum of maturity across militaries, agencies, geographic locations, et cetera.
So. Yeah, you could have an installation where the cameras were put in 15 years ago, which is ancient history in terms of, you know, the logic we now have. Mm-hmm. So how do we know that these devices are getting infected in the first place?
Well, malicious activity was identified by a certain organization within the federal government. And then upon conducting an incident response, doing root cause analysis, and basically tracing it back, you can find patient zero. But I think that there was almost certainly some command and control traffic that likely was identified and then traced back through a particular target and environment where they were able to conduct some follow-on root cause analysis to understand what was happening.
We're speaking with Tom Pace. He's the founder and CEO of NetRise. And by the way, what does NetRise bring to this equation? We'll give you a chance for a 30-second ad here.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. Yeah, so NetRise is a company focused on providing visibility and risk identification into a class of devices that historically have had none. So we focus on analyzing things like IoT, industrial control systems, medical devices, embedded systems in vehicles, satellites, telecommunications equipment. In so doing, we've created a supply chain risk management platform that allows you to identify not just vulnerabilities and things like the software and firmware, but also identify vulnerabilities and risks and other artifacts that exist in those devices, like public keys, private keys, certificates, weak credentials, all that kind of fun stuff, to give it to you in one location.
And some of those have operating systems that could be very many generations behind current operating systems. So
almost
you've got
all
vulnerabilities
of them.
There.
It's actually a very keen observation. The vast majority of them have operating systems that are conservatively 5 years old, or at least a number of the core elements of those operating systems are 5, 10, even 15 years old. Therein lies the problem.
And medical devices, probably throw that into the equation.
Medical devices are some of the worst.
Right. We hear that from VA. We hear that from the, you know, the TRICARE operators. I mean, that's just the system. So what's your advice for CISOs? I mean, who should be responsible for finding out whether my agency has this problem, what the extent of the infrastructure that I have of IoT, non-computing devices, let's call them, who's responsible and what should they do?
Yeah, I mean, there's been plenty of reporting that has found its way throughout the government. So this is definitely a CISO issue. The place you always start is getting an inventory of what you actually have in your environment. There's plenty of very well matured solutions in the space that allow them to do that. Unfortunately, that's where a lot of it ends for most of these agencies. They're really just not even aware that the capabilities exist to give them the inside-out perspective of these devices that is required to understand what is going on here. Most people just believe there's an outside-in picture that's only possible. And also, people have too much trust in some of these devices. So if you look at Volt Typhoon, most people believe that there was a installation in Guam that was likely the first entity that was compromised. And that was compromised by exploiting a vulnerability in a top two firewall vendor. So if your firewall, the very device that's intended to keep ne'er-do-wells out of your network, is the device that is being compromised, we're in a rough state of affairs. What's reality is we've been in that state of affairs now for decades. This is not a new problem.
Sure.
What's happening is these threat groups are staying away from traditional assets because security there has gotten very, very good. I mean, there's very mature solutions there. Solutions have gotten not commensurately better for all of these other devices at all. And in fact, there just hasn't been much innovation, period, which is obviously why we started the company that we started.
And just a technical question, these devices don't appear out of the box to be programmable. I mean, that's the vulnerability of computers and so on, because the standard computing devices are alterable. They're designed to be alterable. Mm-hmm. When you buy a video camera or you buy some kind of an industrial control device, whatever the IoT or peripheral might be, you don't think of those as having their logic alterable or that they have a way to inject new software into them. So what's the mechanism? Let's continue with the camera example. Someone gets through the firewall to that camera. Does the malicious software reside on the firewall monitoring the camera, or do they put something on the camera itself?
It can be both. So there are ways to get things onto these devices. Your opportunities for doing so are, to your point, significantly more limited in comparison to other devices like Windows and traditional Linux-based operating systems. But your point is accurate in the sense that you can't just arbitrarily log into a security camera and change everything. You're dealing with firmware at that point, not software of an operating system.
Right.
So what you are really left with is, A, working with the device manufacturer to ensure that any potential issues that are identified are remediated, or taking other compensating and mitigating controls, which is a pretty well-established process that many organizations can follow. But we're not even there. We're two steps before that. So I oftentimes get this question that you're asking, which is, okay, they put some code on here. Well, like, what do I do now? And it's like, we can't even prove that the code is there or not yet, like at scale in any kind of automated fashion. And that's exactly what we aim to accomplish. And once we get all of that data, the next steps are pretty obvious, and you'll be able to have conversations with organizations, device manufacturers, and users that are very, very data-driven at that point. Right now, it's too spotty.
Tom Pace is founder and CEO of NetRise. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you, sir.
Tom Pace, CEO of NetRise, will post this interview at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Hear the Federal Drive on demand. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected, and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important, so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective. We get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down. So I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you've piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned, or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work, and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is, what do they need when they need it? And building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor. And I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions, and that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion, and then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there, taking notes on the meeting, and said, go ahead, and I want to hear from you. And I realized, in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way, and I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that, I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped, and I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture. And what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful? So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with a intentional focus on culture, because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth, and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency, and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career. And that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been married, happily married, for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. Thank you. Having known you now for 7 or 8 years and worked alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.